Maine's elusive shipwrecks. It was a big deal earlier this summer when news broke of the discovery of the wreck of the USS Eagle 56 off the coast of Cape Elizabeth. The ship actually had been discovered a year earlier, but it was kept secret as divers explored the wreck and a film crew worked on a documentary about it. That documentary, The Hunt for Eagle 56, premieres Sunday on the Smithsonian Channel. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today we'll learn about the discovery, why it was shrouded in mystery, and how it rewrote naval history. We'll also discuss some of the other historic shipwrecks in the Gulf of Maine. Just how many are out there? Are there others as sought after as the Eagle 56? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. This Sunday, the Smithsonian Channel debuts a documentary about the sinking of a Navy boat off the coast of Cape Elizabeth near the end of the Second World War. Today on the show, we will discuss it, The Hunt for Eagle 56, and talk about other famous shipwrecks off our coast. In the studio with me is Kirk Wolfinger. He is co-founder of Lone Wolf Media and the producer and director of Hunt for Eagle 56. He's based here in Maine. On the line with us, Warren Rees and Ryan King. Warren is a research professor emeritus of history at the University of Maine. Ryan is a technical diver with the Nomad Exploration Team. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you have a story about a shipwreck off the coast of Maine? Have you ever been a part of a dive team, or do you want to be? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to all of you. I know that people are fascinated by shipwrecks for all kinds of reasons, and Warren, what is yours?
Well, I have to say I wasn't interested in shipwrecks when I was young. And, sort of lightly interested. And then I went on an archaeology expedition, an underwater archaeology expedition, as a mechanic and assistant photographer. And I became fascinated by the way the archaeologists analyzed the information they were getting from the shipwreck and interpreted it with what people thought about this is a merchant ship, it was a Roman merchant ship in the Mediterranean. And we're actually changing what we knew about history right there over lunch based on what we had found and the information from that morning. And that really turned my life around, and I just became fascinated with shipwrecks after that, as sources of information.
And their ability to change history. And that's so interesting because one of the themes, the central themes, Kirk, in your film is about how discovering the shipwreck is changing history. And I want to talk about the documentary in just a minute. But first, I just want to say to you, I know that this is not your first film about shipwrecks. What is it about them for you? Why do you find them so endlessly fascinating?
Well, shipwrecks are, as Warren was saying, they're microcosms. They're a look into history. 2 weeks ago, I was in Sweden diving on a 524-year-old shipwreck called the Gribshunden, which is identical almost to Columbus's ships of discovery, the Santa Maria. We don't have any actual wrecks that are Columbus's ships of discovery. So if you want to see it, this ship in the Baltic that we were just diving on is one of the few that you can look at. And it's fascinating to see the kind of construction to retrieve artifacts, including barrels and copper and chainmail from the crossbows. We were picking all those up. So when you go to a shipwreck, you're getting a firsthand look at history.
Touching for the first time in 524 years, something the last human to touch lived in an entirely different world. Ryan, you have been diving and photographing and filming shipwrecks for more than a quarter century. Tell me about the moment of discovery.
So, I mean, the first time that we saw the Eagle 56, I mean, we've been looking for this wreck for about 5 years, kind of consistently. And we got down there. And actually, I was on the second team that day. I was sitting up top waiting to hear the results of the dive. But we got down there, the divers started swimming towards where they thought the wreck was going to be, and just out of the gloom comes this giant wall of steel. And from there, you knew you at least had a wreck, but we had no idea what it was. And as they were able to swim up that wall of steel, they got up to a point where they got to the deckhouse, and on top of the deckhouse is a massive 16-foot gun. And so we were fairly certain at that point in time that we were going to be able to give some closure to the families and actually identify the Eagle 56. It was absolutely awe-inspiring.
Well, Ryan, you're taking us right to the Eagle 56, so I'm going to go back to Kirk, and I'm going to say, tell us about the Eagle 56. This is a World War II ship. What was it doing when it went down? How did it go down, and what was the mystery? It was an explosion, right?
It was an explosion, indeed. And it actually was a World War I ship, Jennifer. It was
World War II, but it's World War
built
I ship.
Built by Henry Ford in World War I. So it'd been around a long time, and by the time it was in service here off the coast of Maine, it was pretty much pulling targets for the Naval Air Station in Brunswick. They would fly the planes, and Eagle was pulling targets behind it so that the aviators could practice. The war was nearly over. Of course, we didn't know that it was nearly over, but everybody sensed it was coming to a close. And the Eagle was just doing a routine patrol, pulling targets, and all of a sudden, it just blew up in the middle of the day, in the middle of the afternoon, just a few miles off the coast. People on shore could see it blow up, and 49 men died. 13 survived. They were in the water. There were 26 who ended up in the water alive, but of those, only 13 survived. The rest were killed. Were killed by exposure to the water. It was April, and it was very cold. So it was just a ship thinking that we're on pretty easy duty here. We're thousands of miles away from where the action is. It's a lovely day in April, and we're just doing our job. And in the middle of that, an explosion that they believed, the Navy said at the time, was a boiler explosion, hit the midships of the ship. But then a few of the survivors in the water said, "We thought we saw the conning tower of a U-boat." Now, for a lot of folks, a U-boat off the coast of America that close is kind of an astounding revelation. But the fact is, U-boats were patrolling up and down our coast early in the war and then later in the war. So that was a little known fact.
So really important to find this shipwreck because it solves the mystery. Was it indeed a boiler, or could potentially solve the mystery? Was it a boiler explosion, or was it a German U-boat? How come this wreck has not been found sooner?
Well, and that's a good one for me because I started looking for this wreck with some other folks 18 years ago. And it's only a few miles off the coast of
right. You
of
said
Maine.
People saw right. it from the shore.
People saw it explode. It's like, how hard could this be? Well, it turns out to be very hard. And Ryan can elaborate. But the topography of the seabed in and around Maine, as everyone knows, if you just look at the rocky coast, well, that's what's going on underneath. And so when you go looking for a shipwreck using a magnetometer, sensing iron, well, everything's iron out there. So it's like looking for a needle in a haystack of needles. It was very hard to find. We thought we were going to find it 16, 18 years ago. We gave up. And we started to make a movie then, and we gave up. And then it wasn't until Ryan and the Nomad crew called me two summers ago and said, guess what we've got, that we resumed the making of the film.
Okay, Ryan, pick up the story from there. How'd you find it?
Well, we had spent 4 years, as Kirk mentioned, with a magnetometer trying to find big iron deposits on the coast of Maine, but all the rocks in Maine have iron in them, and I swear we probably dove more barren rock ledges than I care to count. But eventually, last summer, the fall of the winter of 2018, we got a hold of some different scans. We started really looking at whether or not where this thing might be. And we had a couple of interesting targets. We talked to a few other people that also had some areas where they thought the wreck might be. And we just resolved that we were going to dive everything that looked interesting until we finally found the Eagle. And so we had a set of numbers, a set of GPS coordinates. We went out there. We dropped the shot weight, which is just a big heavy weight that hopefully will stay near the wreck and doesn't get pulled off by the current. And then started dropped two divers down the line. And they went down, they found the wreck. Their job was to go ahead and let a bottle go so that we knew that they had found the wreck. And Danny Allen and I, who were sitting topside waiting, 20 minutes went by, we saw nothing. And we figured, all right, well, we got another rock pile. And then the bottle came up, and the celebration was incredible.
Mm. Kirk?
Well, you know, the other thing that's interesting about shipwrecks and finding shipwrecks, just a couple of miles off the coast, there's this ship that had been there for 70-some years, and nobody could find it because the topography is so confusing. The ship was in two pieces. One piece was in one area, and only 100 meters away, the second piece in a completely different topography. Now, I've been to Titanic. I've dived on Titanic. And Titanic is in the middle of the ocean. And if you are lucky enough to find it, as Bob Ballard did back in 1986, and once you know where it is, it's easy to see because it's in the middle of sand. It's just you can see it from 2,000 feet above. Oh, well, there's a ship. Now, it took a while to find it there, but once you got onto it, it was easy to find because the topography in the middle of the ocean is so flat and sandy. You can see shipwrecks. This one was elusive because of the topography.
And, Ryan, I read 300 feet deep. For people who are not divers, talk about how difficult a dive that is.
So it's a little shy of 300 feet deep, but that's a dive where on the way down you're looking at about 4 to 5 minutes of just dropping through the water column in the water that is no more than 42 degrees. And then you can spend 20 to 25 minutes on the bottom, and the visibility is, on a good day, 5 to 10 feet. On a regular day, it's more like 5 feet. On a really good day, which we had just a couple of times, it's 20 feet. So you get down there, you can spend 20 to 25 minutes exploring, and then you have between an hour and a half and 3 hours on the way back up, depending on how long you stayed. So you're making just a slow ascent and then stopping every once in a while, and then your stops get longer and longer until you get to the surface or to the about 10 or 20-foot stop where you could spend upwards of an hour just hanging out and waiting for the nitrogen to leave your system so that you can safely surface.
Warren Reese.
Diving in New England.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Ryan.
Diving in New England, especially diving off the coast of Maine, is definitely no joke.
And
the water is cold.
It's dangerous.
Right,
it's very dangerous stuff. Diving to those depths, which doesn't sound like a much, 300 feet, 235 feet. The depth, the conditions of the water, how cold it is, it's real easy to lose track of where you are. It's real easy for equipment to fail. It's not without serious risk.
Warren Reese, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Talk about the significance of this discovery.
Hi, Jennifer. Well, from my point of view, I think Kirk put his finger right on it. Was the closure of, you know, was this a torpedo like the people on board said it might have been, or was it a blast from the steam engine? And the families, you know, wanted to know what happened and to figure this out for them. The other thing is I've always had a question when I first heard about this site, knowing it that it was one of the Eagle-class patrol boats. There had been some disagreement at the time they built these about the quality of the workmanship, that the Ford employees had thrown these things together quickly, that they had problems with them, they had to get fixed. Others said, oh, no, they were good. That was just being said to get more money out of the federal government and stuff. And here we have the evidence. I don't know if anybody wants to go back 300 feet down to look for that, but I'd be curious for that. So, you know, my interests are in a much earlier period, but at the same time, this is a significant find. I imagine Kirk and Ryan, as the Navy's underwater archaeology team, been involved at all with you?
So we had an opportunity to go down to see the Navy in February of last year. So our big goal, as soon as we discovered the first piece of the wreck, was to be able, over the course of the summer, to put together as complete a picture as possible to be able to bring to the Navy so that the Navy could make the final determination that this was actually the Eagle 56.
Yeah.
I mentioned the piece about the family earlier, and we didn't want to be the people that made the determination because we didn't want to have to walk that back. It just felt like it was the right thing to do. It's the Navy's vessel, and it's their call. So we had a chance to go see them. We presented our findings, and then they spent about 3 months evaluating what we did, and finally came back to us in May with the determination that this was actually the Eagle 56. I don't know if they're going to send anybody from their underwater archaeology branch, but I do know that they're interested in what we've found and what we've done, and have been a great asset and as we've been working through this project.
Warren, mm-hmm. Warren, how many shipwrecks are off the coast of Maine?
Well, you better sit down, because we, over the decades, I say we, the number of us, collected a database which the Maine Historic Preservation Commission keeps, and they have now over 1,600 shipwrecks, documented shipwrecks off the coast of Maine since the Europeans arrived.
Wow, over 1,600 shipwrecks off the coast of Maine.
Those
when someone uses
that
expression, off the coast of Maine, are we talking within how many miles of the coast?
Oh, well, that's the big question, because you get reports such as sank off of Pemaquid Point with no distance and no direction. You know, so
but close enough to know it was off Pemaquid Point.
Exactly. So maybe it was seen from them, or somebody could see the light or something. So probably within about 30 miles or so. Most of them will have been within about 5 miles of the coast. Mm. You get a concentration near the ports and in very shallow waters, rocks. In southern Maine, you have the sandbars. And a lot of them would be driven on shore by either a storm or even a calm. I mean, a vessel could be becalmed and then a current takes it, or sunken because something went wrong, or from warfare. And you can actually multiply this probably by 1.5 to 2. It's over 2,000 anyway, maybe 3,000 wrecks probably, which seems like a phenomenal number. But there are many sites that were just never recorded. Small vessels, fishing vessels, they didn't bother recording that until probably the mid-1800s. Before that, it just wasn't that important, even if lives were lost, to record it anywhere in any archive we would find. Also, you have vessels that left Boston or New York and didn't show up in London or Bristol, England, or vice versa, and some of those will have gone down. We just wouldn't even know about it.
Well, Warren, you spoke of Pemaquid. When we come back, I'm going to ask you what's going on up there. I'm also going to ask Kirk a little bit more. We haven't even talked about the repercussions of what you found, but we do need to go to a break. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Friends of Acadia, members and volunteers preserving the splendor of Acadia National Park for current and future generations. Friendsofacadia.org. Evergreen Home Performance, helping homeowners address climate change with energy audits, window replacement, and insulation. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And First Pier, specializing in Shopify and offering strategic retail and e-commerce solutions in Portland and beyond. FirstPier.com.
As some states try to make it more difficult or even illegal to get an abortion in a clinic, activists are spreading the word about another option. Women can induce abortion on their own without a doctor using pills.
My friend that was with me, she was kind of like shocked about how easy it was to, like, no questions, no nothing.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. Season 4 of High School Quiz Show Maine wants your school to take part. This fall, there will be a qualifying test to select the top 16 schools that will compete in statewide television contests broadcast next spring. If your school is interested, we'd like to hear from you. And starting tonight, you can watch a rebroadcast of Season 3 Thursday evenings at 8 on Maine Public Television. Information about High School Quiz Show Maine is at mainepublic.org. Just click on television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, shipwrecks off the coast of Maine. In the studio with me, Kirk Wolfinger. He is co-founder of Lone Wolf Media and is the producer and director of Hunt for Eagle 56. That is going to debut Sunday night on the Smithsonian Channel. On the line with us, Warren Reese and Ryan King. Warren is research professor emeritus of history at the University of Maine and a shipwreck expert. And Ryan is a technical diver with the Nomad Exploration Team who did discover the wreck of Eagle 56. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now, Nathan Garrett, another one of the technical divers on the team. Hi, Nathan. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Jennifer. I'm glad to be here with you.
So, Nathan, you know, I don't know if you've been able to hear the conversation so far, but just wanted to ask you, you've also dived a lot of wrecks. What does the Eagle 56 mean to you?
Well, you know, at first, I didn't realize the significance of what we had until family members started contacting us and stuff. Anytime we can discover a new wreck that nobody's been to is exciting. To be part of the team that discovered this and brought closure to so many families, brought information back that nobody knew for sure until we brought it back, it's pretty big for me. I mean, as far as the diving goes, it's the highlight of my diving career for sure.
Wow. Well, let's talk about that. Kirk, we sort of hinted during the first section of this program what you found out, that this was not a boiler explosion. And all these years, all these families who suspected something else had happened were right.
Right. That is correct. And I want to make sure that we credit, in addition to Ryan and the Nomad team, Nate, all those guys, they did a fabulous job. And it was, you know, nobody's paying them to do this. This cost them a lot of their own finances, a lot of their own time. Yeah, it's sport, it's recreational, but they were at it doggedly. And they really did manage to reveal something of history that's very important. But we have to go back 18 years to Paul Lawton, a lawyer from Boston and a diver who became bitten by this mystery. He knew some of the sons of one of the guys who died on the boat, and they always said, you know, that boat's right there off the coast of Maine. Nobody's been able to find it. And Paul went looking. He never found it, but what he did do is he used his lawyerly skills, and he went back into the records, and he managed to convince the Navy 18 years ago that it was not a boiler explosion, that it was a U-boat. And the Navy changed the official record, and that's a very interesting story unto itself that I won't give away totally. But the Navy was willing to change the record, but they never really did contact any more of the family members than the ones that Paul knew. So there was a small circle of people, like 13, 14 people. But their crew of the Eagle were over 60 people. And there are 60 families out there that never knew that the record was changed. And even though the Navy was willing to say, yeah, we think you're right. We think there was a U-boat in the area, and we think we can probably give these guys Purple Hearts for a combat action. Until the Nomad crew found the wreck, until we found the boilers to prove that they were intact, it was just hypothetical.
And these family members now have Purple Hearts.
And these family members now, and we went down to Tennessee recently. Ryan and Jeff and I went down to Tennessee to give one of the few African-American sailors on board, his family, their Purple Heart for the young man who never came back. And that was an incredibly emotional experience.
Well, Nathan, I really appreciate you. Nate, I appreciate you calling in and joining the conversation today. Warren, I want to turn to you as a historian. I understand this is the only time the Navy has changed the record. Was there... would there have been a reason that the Navy did not want to record this as a U-boat attack in World War II?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I don't know who first said it, but the first failure in war is truth. You know, each side is going to tell lies, not only to keep the spirits of their own people up, but to try to fool the enemy. So they didn't want the Germans to know that one of the submarines had been successful. And they didn't want the American public to know that there was a submarine right off the coast here that the Navy wasn't, or the Air Force wasn't able to get. Now, they didn't know that it was there, but it was suspected. So that is often done with a it'd be a battle, and the good guys say they lost a third as many as they really did, and so did the other side. It's normal.
We're going to go to Edward, who's calling in from North Berwick. Hi, Edward. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm calling about the shipwreck in York Beach, Short Sands. It comes on Earth every once in a blue moon, and they don't know a whole lot about it. But one of the last times it was on Earth, a group of scientists took samples of wood from the hull to do some more research on it to try to figure out what ship it was. I'm wondering if any of the people on the panel today know anything more about that shipwreck.
Warren, do you know about the shipwreck on Short Sands Beach in York?
Yes. In fact, I went down there and took a look at it maybe 20 years ago. And, I'm not sure I have this right, but I believe Stefan Clausen was the archaeologist who took a close look at it recently and took the samples. And I believe that he came to the conclusion that it was late 18th century, late 1700s, basically, probably a coastal vessel, would be, I believe, a large schooner or a brigantine. And that's about all I remember from, I just read two paragraphs about it from a
Edward, thanks so much for your call. If you have a question, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll go to Sean, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Sean. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I've just got a quick question for Nate. I'm wondering how you got into this, and also, as somebody that's very excited by this idea, if somebody wanted to start doing this, like, how would we go about it? I assume there's a lot of research and, probably some money that has to go into this, but so if you could speak about that.
Sure. Sean, we don't have Nate anymore, but I'll ask Ryan your question. Go ahead, Ryan.
So I can jump on that. Nate actually is from Vermont, which is the irony of you calling and asking that question, because Nate drives about 4 hours each time we come to go diving. But the diving, as far as getting started with it, you're looking at find a local dive shop or a local instructor, and you start out doing a basic open water course, and then you start picking up your gear, and then it's really just about getting the experience. And the more time you spend diving is probably more valuable to you than taking additional courses right away. Diving is one of those sports that you can do you can do it as a 10-year-old kid and all the way up. There's really no end to it. And you can take it wherever you want to go. If you want to see pretty fish in the Caribbean, you can do that, or even in Vermont. And Vermont has a number of mines. They have shipwrecks in Lake Champlain. And then you have all of the coastal waters as well. So, it's a sport you can take and pretty much go anywhere with. And when I used to teach and work in a dive shop, I used to say it was like skiing. Once you bought your gear, you were all set and ready to go. And you could just go whenever you want. At least you don't have to pay for the lift ticket.
Sean, thanks so much for not the lift ticket, but maybe the boat.
Well, thanks. Yeah, so that was the one thing I didn't necessarily always bring up.
Thanks so much for calling in, Sean. Kirk, there's a real subculture, isn't there? There is a world, not just here in the United States, but are all around the world, of divers and historians and archaeologists who come to know each other and become fascinated by these shipwrecks.
Oh yeah, it is quite the subculture, and enormous too. There are so many people who dive. Now the shipwreck culture is unique unto itself, also very big. But I first went with Bob Ballard way long ago to dive on Titanic's sister ship, the Britannic, and that was my first exposure to diving. That was 20 some years ago. And since then, I've done Deep Sea Detectives for History Channel, which every week was a different shipwreck. And we've done Titanic. We've done the USS Indianapolis. And, it is both diving, and then there's the remote sensing, the, you know, the autonomous vehicles that go down 3,000, 4,000 feet to see shipwrecks where, like where Indianapolis is, which is literally 3 miles beneath the surface. And it's, again, it's just fascinating. It's you get down to these ships and you look and you say, this is time frozen. Whatever happened when this ship went down, it's all right here. And you can see, you can do a, if you're into the whole forensics of it, you can do an analysis of why did the ship sink. If you're just into the anthropology of it, you can say, how was the ship constructed? So there's a million things. You know, on this shipwreck we were just on in Sweden, it was we know this ship was, it sank in 1495. That's 3 years after Columbus came to America, 1495. But the ship was built in 1482, and we know it because a dendrochronologist, somebody who samples wood.
A dendrochronologist, okay.
Somebody who samples wood, sampled a piece of the hull and figured out that the wood came from France and was cut in 1482. I mean, that is really being able to forensically examine a ship.
So you, as you've mentioned, have dived shipwrecks and filmed this all over the world. What does it mean to you to film one right off the coast of southern Maine, off Cape Elizabeth?
It was a dream come true. It's like, oh, I don't have to get on a plane and go somewhere. That's terrific. And the fact is, as you well know, that shipwreck I could almost walk to from my house if I could walk on water because it's so close. I can go to Fort Williams and look out, and you can see exactly where that ship is now that we know where it is precisely. So it was great. It was, and also because of the local culture, a lot of people in Portland knew about the Eagle 56, and a lot of them said, "Oh, my father remembers, and my mother remembers, the ship and the incident." But we never knew what happened, you know.
And now we know. And you're not even going to tell us all the secrets today because people are going to have to watch.
Going to have to watch.
We're going to go to Rich, who's calling from Moosehead. Hi, Rich. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. What a great subject. I dove on logs on Moosehead Lake in the 90s, and we were always around the steamships that had plied the waters hauling the logs. And I just want to make a comment that Moosehead's got some great wrecks to dive on as well. I said, thank you for taking my call.
I appreciate it, Rich. Warren, you want to talk about some of the shipwrecks on Moosehead Lake?
I don't know Moosehead. I mean, I know of Moosehead Lake, but I don't know the shipwrecks there. I'm sorry to tell you.
That's okay. That's okay.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. And Rich, I appreciate you calling in. Why don't I ask you then, Warren, about what is going on off the coast of Pemaquid? I understand there's another one of these wrecks that people have wanted to find for years. Tell me about it.
Oh, now you're embarrassing me. We looked for a site that's probably the most significant site off the coast of Maine that we know of, called Angel Gabriel. She went down in 1635 in a hurricane. And
1635. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was owned by, it was a merchant ship. It was owned by the same person who owned the settlement of Pemaquid. And it was a supply ship with a few passengers on it. And it went down when this huge hurricane hit. And when I was a graduate student in nautical archaeology, I grabbed a bunch of my friends, and we started looking for it. And we looked for it for many summers, a couple of weeks each summer, never found it. And I finally gave up and went on to other shipwrecks, but ones that either others had found or we found easily and were able to excavate. So there it sits somewhere out there. So I'm hoping that Ryan will bring his people up and find it. I don't think you'll need your technical diving skills. This is going to be fairly shallow by your standards. But
we would be happy to come up and take a look.
Yeah, it's significant because we don't know too much about the early settlements in New England, in Maine especially. This would have been filled with all kinds of trading goods, passengers, supplies. We don't know much about the way they built merchant ships at that time. We know something about how they built the warships. So for a number of reasons, we're quite interested in the site. There are a lot of land archaeologists, too, who are interested because we can tie down certain artifacts, you know, where they found a certain, I'm just making this up off the top of my head, a certain type of bowl on a number of sites, and they could only say, oh, well, this was used sometime between 1600 and 1700. Well, if we found that bowl or a similar bowl on this vessel, we could say, well, this was used August 15, 1635. Then it will help them tie down dates on certain artifacts that they don't have tied down yet.
Kirk.
Well, there's back to the idea of shipwrecks and frozen in time, and as Warren is talking about going to Pemaquid and uncovering and looking into history, one of the beautiful things about a shipwreck, as opposed to land archaeology, is a shipwreck is literally an enclosed environment. When that ship sank, that world sank with it. And you can go into that world and you can examine that world and say, oh, this is what life was like at this time. This is these were the armaments they used. These were the instruments they used. This was the clothing they wore. If you
it
can
had
find
everything.
That. It had everything, and it's frozen in time, as opposed to land archaeology, where I've done a few of those shows as well, where you dig a little bit and you go, oh, this must have been right around the turn of the century. Oh, but no, it's confused because the layer is mixed with this layer and you're not sure what century it came from. With a ship, you know. That ship went down in 1635, and everything on that ship is going to date to that time, and you can therefore get a look into that time period with that ship.
Kirk, you're going to turn all of us into archaeologists or divers. We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Salaam Circus School in Biddeford. With professional and recreational circus arts training and classes for all ages and abilities, salaamcircus.com. And Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
I'm Greg Dalton. On the next Climate One, from stadiums packed with fans to food, beer, and waste, pro sports can have a big carbon footprint.
One opportunity for fans is to hold those stadiums and those teams accountable. You know, when the fans or the customers start saying this is important to them, then usually businesses start to listen, right?
How pro sports can be a climate player on the next Climate One.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. All this week, Maine Public is joining NPR and hundreds of other news outlets from around the world in providing special coverage of climate change and its impacts on our state and our world. You can hear Covering Climate Now on Maine Public Radio during our regular news programs and find more information at mainepublic.org/climatenow. The special series Covering Climate Now is being presented in advance of the United Nations Climate Action Summit taking place in New York on Monday, September 23rd.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, shipwrecks off the coast of Maine. In the studio with me, Kirk Wolfinger, co-founder of Lone Wolf Media and the producer and director of Hunt for Eagle 56. On the line with us, Warren Reese and Ryan King. Warren is a research professor emeritus of history at the University of Maine, and Ryan is a technical diver with the Nomad Exploration Team, which discovered the wreck of Eagle 56. We'd love you to join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you might be able to get in an email or a text. That's talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I have an email here from Travis. He says, any wreckage salvaged from the Penobscot exhibition, the second biggest U.S. naval disaster in our country, 1779. Paul Revere was court-martialed for cowardice and was honorably discharged. This is your era, Warren. What do you know about the Penobscot expedition?
Oh, quite a bit.
Go ahead.
Okay, when I was a grad student, I cut my teeth on the first site that I worked out in America on a ship called the Defense, which was one of the vessels of the Penobscot expedition. And that was fascinating. We did excavate that slowly over, Dave Switzer was the director of it, and I was just staff, but we excavated that over about 7 years, seven summers, and very slowly mapped everything out, as archaeologists do, and all the artifacts are conserved in there at the Maine State Museum. There's over 2,000 artifacts. And to expound a little bit about what Kirk was saying, yes, this was a day, a particular day in 1779, and everything on that vessel was from that day. But the thing I want to add to what he was saying is that from archaeology in general, and very specifically from shipwreck archaeology, we learn about everyday people. If you go into the archives, as I've spent a lot of time doing, one will find mostly about the few white guys who were in charge of everything. And there is some information there about the other 99.9% of the people, like four of us. And but on this vessel, here's the information. This is how they lived. This is the silk ribbon that someone put in their hair. These are his shoes. This is the meat tag that they used to identify who had put their meat in the cauldron and who hadn't. So, yeah, wonderful. So the Defense was one of 40 vessels that was sunk. It was an invasion fleet, really, mostly carrying an army up to attack the British. And then it was cornered by a British squadron. And the Americans basically went up the river, and as the British would catch up to them, they would take the small vessel, run it ashore, jump off, and light fire to it, which was a standard thing to do so that the enemy didn't get a new ship.
And how many American ships were destroyed?
Well, there were 40 vessels approximately. Every list you see at that was written at the time is different, but about 40 ships. The British captured three, I believe, and the rest of them were sunk or exploded. And the Defense, luckily for us, it was sunk in by its own crew in a shallow harbor with very soft mud. So it sank down, and that soft mud very quickly sealed it off so that things that would eat organics couldn't get to it. So we had leather, we had silk, we had wood, we had all kinds of, we had blueberries and bones from the food. So we could tell all of that about them.
Wow. Well, thank you for that email, Travis. Really, really interesting. An email from Steve. A Maine shipwreck is featured in my family history. My great-grandfather Richard was captain of the Polius, a concrete-hulled vessel carrying coal, medicine, and other supplies to Maine during the Spanish flu pandemic of the winter of 1918. Off the coast of Port Clyde, dense fog was rolling in ahead of a bad storm, but the weather report Richard received was mistakenly one day behind. The Polius ran aground, and several crew members disobeyed Richard's orders and abandoned ship. Apparently, they were never seen again, but those who remained on board were all rescued. After a subsequent investigation and hearing, Richard was cleared of any wrongdoing and soon captained another ship. Today, if you visit Marshall Point Lighthouse, you can see artifacts from the Polius in the museum, and on a clear day at low tide, you can see remnants of the hull. Well, Steve, thank you so much for that question. And then an email from Paul. For the historians, the Germans of World War II were notorious record keepers. Is there corroborating evidence from Germany that recorded torpedoing a ship the very day Eagle 56 sunk?
Actually, no, there is no record because the U-352, 853, so many U-boats, so many numbers. It was sunk off of Newport, Rhode Island 2 weeks later. And so all the records that would have been there would have gone down with the ship. And they were maintaining radio silence back to Germany. So there was no record of hey, we just sank this ship. Now we're going to move on and get this, which was part of the mystery that we needed to solve is we know that, okay, so the U-boat was in the area, as Paul Lawton had proven. But did that mean it actually sank the ship? And that we couldn't prove that until we actually found the boilers. When the boys found the boilers intact, we knew it wasn't a boiler explosion. It had to have been a torpedo.
Ryan, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, because the U-boat was maintaining radio silence, there's no records back there. But what we can certainly say, as Kirk just mentioned, when we found the boilers, and you'll see this in the documentary, it's obvious that there was no boiler explosion.
We'll go to Martin, who's calling from Otis Field, Martin?
Otis.
Oh, go right ahead.
All right. I wanted to talk about the Thresher. It's a little offshore of Maine, but it was built, it sunk in April 10th, 1963, the nuclear submarine Thresher. I would like it looked at. It would have to be done with robotics today. But I believe that they lost control of their diving planes, the ones up on the sail planes, the ones up high. As an apprentice, I hooked up the system. I saw it fail on another boat that was in dry dock. And I think that the thing went to a full rise and came to the surface and everything died and it slipped back under.
Oh, wow.
And I think that if it was looked at, that primary planesman's diving station, there's a big handle in front of his feet that would be switched over to the right, which is an emergency position, indicating that they had lost control of those diving planes. And after that, of course, everything failed once they were all out of shape.
Kirk? Yeah, there is, I know that actually Bob Ballard went and examined it when he was part of Navy intelligence, and there are pictures of Thresher spread out all over the bottom. It was a catastrophic event, and I don't know if that handle still exists, if you'd be able to look at it, but all the theories about Thresher are nuclear power was so new at that time, nuclear submarines were even newer, and there was a lot of there was a long learning curve for the captains, and there's some hypothesis that he got into a diving plane situation just as you've articulated, and he shut down the nuclear reactor trying to stop the downward spiral. And, of course, once you shut down a nuclear reactor, you just don't start it up again. And so he may have doomed the whole ship to that. Now, we don't know that for a fact. I've had captains who've talked to me about that, nuclear submarine captains, say they think that's what might have happened. But you are dead on about the diving planes. They believe they got stuck.
What do you mean by diving planes, Kirk?
The diving planes for the submarine that make it go up and make it go down. They were locked down because they were doing they were on a checkout cruise for the Thresher, and they think they may have gotten stuck. They started to make their way down, and you know, you get to a certain depth, and the whole submarine's just going to implode from the pressure. And they think these guys got stuck and weren't able to reverse it.
Such a horrible disaster. Martin, thank you so much for calling. We're going to go to Rich again in Moosehead. Hi, Rich.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to give them the information that the wrecks on Moosehead are called the Priscilla and the Twilight. The Twilight's in Moosehead Junction and at Steamship Point, and the Priscilla's in East Cove in the center of Greenville Town where the old Atlas Plywood Mill. And one more is the Moosehead on Sandbar Island up by Mount Kineo. So I just wanted to call you back and give you that information.
Thanks so much. Warren, you've said the low number of the number of shipwrecks off the coast of Maine, that's not even counting inland and places like Moosehead, is at least 1,600. How come we haven't discovered more of them?
Well, quite honestly, it's because we're a very poor state. We don't have the resources. We have one of the lowest per capita incomes, and not too many people live in the state. And there are other priorities like feeding everybody. And we have, you know, today we have the opioid crisis and the climate change crisis that's hitting us already in Maine. And it's kind of hard to say, oh, yeah, but we need some of those resources to go out and find another shipwreck so that we can study it. As important as I feel they are, I also understand the state just has other priorities.
Kirk, do you have a dream shipwreck off the coast of Maine that you want to explore now that you've found Eagle 56?
I don't have any dream shipwrecks. We're looking at various shipwrecks. We were on the Indianapolis a couple of years ago, which was just discovered. You know, I like the big iconic ones. I think they're interesting. This one in Sweden that it was a Danish ship is fascinating because until somebody presented me with that as a possibility, I didn't know anything about it. And so you start to read and you get a look into that world. So I'm interested in shipwrecks no matter where they are.
Okay, Ryan, what about you? Where's your dream next project?
Well, I think we have a couple different projects off the coast of Maine that we're looking at. Some of them are up by Bar Harbor. There was actually was a ship that was torpedoed up off of Bar Harbor right in the middle of World War II. And then actually just the other day, I came across a revenue cutter that was actually stolen from or hijacked by Confederate soldiers and taken out of Portland Harbor. And she was burned to the waterline and sunk off of Portland Harbor. That seems like it would be kind of a fun place to go. I think that Kirk probably will if we do find something, I think Kirk would love to join us as long as it's on a bigger boat. Right, Kirk?
And what does that mean?
Oh, you know, for somebody who's done as many shipwrecks as I do, I am very prone to seasickness. So,
oh, no.
You know, oh, yeah. So, like, I always say, don't you know, I'm not getting on a boat unless somebody's paying me. But actually, the adventure is quite good. But you're right, Ryan. You know, we got to get a bigger boat.
Well, Ryan, to go back to what I'd asked Warren about the cost of these shipwrecks, how are you all funded? I mean, this is a big deal. How do you figure out how to pay for doing this work?
Well, so, I mean, we are all self-funded, and we just, this is something that we do for fun. And so, I mean, we will get together and everybody sort of splits costs. And, you know, over time, we've picked up different gear and picked up different equipment that we've needed. I mean, we started out looking for the Eagle 56 with a 22-foot boat and quickly realized that off the coast of Maine in a 22-foot boat can get a little dicey pretty quick. And many of our dives, as Kirk mentioned earlier, they're fairly long dives, and it's fairly dangerous stuff. So you needed to have a boat that was up to the task. And that's when we bought Nomad, and that's kind of where the name for the team came up. But I think the key thing to keep in mind with us and kind of funding this is that I'm here talking to you today. Nate called in. But there are six other guys that are involved in this team, and I actually would probably say six other families. If everybody knew exactly what was being spent, that might be different. But those six other guys, Mark Bowers, Danny Allen, Bob Foster, Jeff Goodrow, and Josh Cummings, as well as Don Ferrara, they all put their own money and time into this to be able to make it work. And so we do it for fun. And this wreck, the Eagle 56 in particular, became one of those wrecks that we felt that we just had to find. Initially, we started thinking it would be a really cool project, and then we as we started to do more research, we got to sort of feel like we knew the families and that we had the ability, and we had the equipment, and we had the opportunity, and so we really felt like we had to go find this wreck so we could provide some closure for those families. And
I'm so sorry, Ryan. I have to cut you off because we're almost out of time. The documentary, three parts, premieres Sunday night on the Smithsonian Channel, produced by Kirk Wolfinger, who's sitting across from me. He's co-founder of Lone Wolf Media, producer and director of the project Hunt for Eagle 56. You just heard Ryan King, a technical diver with the Nomad Exploration Team, and Warren Reese from UMaine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Public Radio.